from KQED.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Around Valentine's Day, hearts are everywhere, but do you know where the symbol originally came from? This Valentine's Day, we're going to talk with scholar and author Marilyn Yalom about her new book, The Amorous Heart, and what she does in the book is essentially follow heart imagery throughout history, from the origins of its two-lobe shape to how it became a worldwide emblem of romantic longing, lust, and loss. Marilyn Yalom is senior scholar at Stanford University's Clayman Institute for Gender, and the book is called The Amorous Heart. Let me give the subtitle, An Unconventional History of Love, and welcome back to Forum, Marilyn Yalom.
Hi.
Hi. Well, let's get to it. Let's go with you to the British Museum. That's where it all starts, huh?
That's where it started. In the spring of 2011, I was at the British Museum with my friend James Robinson, who at that time was the medieval curator, and he wanted me to see an exhibition of medieval items, including the famous hoard from Nottinghamshire, which is known as the Fishpool Hoard. And it consists of coins and jewelry. And my eyes fixated upon a heart-shaped brooch from about the 14th, 15th century.
And you yelled Eureka or
exactly,
something like that. Yeah.
Exactly. The light bulb went on in my head. It flashed and I saw all those hearts I'd grown up with, Valentine's and, of course, boxes of candy in the shape of hearts and the little pendant that I wear at my neck with a heart in glass. And I turned to James and I said, where did that heart shape come from? And he, being knowledgeable, said, well, it was already common by the 14th century in jewelry, such as that beautiful brooch I saw before me, which was French in origin, and many of the original pieces of jewelry and luxury items came from France and were sent to England at that time.
This bi-lobe symbol, though, is very strange, as you point out in your book, when you think about it in, well, contrast to the way the heart really looks. You use the word ungainly. I mean, this strange-looking organ, and here's this just bi-lobe thing that has come to stand for and symbolize in iconic ways and in every way imaginable. I mean, in fact, you get into sort of the division not only between the amorous heart, but the spiritual use of, you know, heart and Jesus and heart and God and Augustine and all the rest of it.
Well, the interesting thing is that the heart representing love, both amorous and religious, wasn't originally in the shape that we know it now. It didn't originally have two lobes and a point at the bottom. The first examples of the heart as a symbol of love were pine cone shaped around 1250. And that was because Galen in the second century, the famous physician, had said that the heart was shaped like a pine cone. And so, of course, without looking, people just repeated over and over again in the medical and in the artistic world that the heart was shaped like a pine cone or an eggplant or a pear. And that's what you see in a manuscript of 1250, a man offering his
pine cone
to a woman. And she would have understood this, and everybody else in the Middle Ages would have understood it as a heart offering. And it took about 100 years for the shape to evolve from a pine cone to the symmetrical, beautiful, perfect, bi-lobed heart that we are familiar with today.
But you get into a lot of the associations with the heart. For example, we get into how the Egyptians identified the heart with the soul.
They did. And also the early Hebrews. And all through Judeo-Christianity and Islam, you have references to the heart as the home of the soul, as the place of contact between an individual and God. And St. Augustine speaks about his own heart that thirsts after God. And there's a whole strain of Christian mystics who speak about their focus, their obsessive focus with the heart of Jesus, including some of the female saints who write about their encounter with Jesus's heart as if it were written for a love story, for a romance of the 12th or 13th century.
Well, you mentioned Augustine. I mean, there was a real division in Augustine between the chaste heart and the lustful heart.
Which... Exactly. I think we owe it to Augustine that the heart was divided at that point between the chaste heart and the lustful heart, with a great emphasis upon the lustful heart. And the strain within Christianity that anything that is physical and erotic is evil.
Well, in fact, as you point out, you don't find much of the heart in biblical text, except for maybe the Song of Solomon, which is a wonderful
example.
Exactly.
You do get the heart in the Bible, but it usually represents the one's most moral and spiritual self in relationship to God. And there are proverbs that that tell us that we should pay attention to our heart because everything else comes from that. And that's a strain that goes right through Western culture. Follow your heart. In fact, one of the symbols that I like the best is a 19th century hand symbol from the International Order of Odd Fellows that shows an upright hand with a heart at the center of it. And that suggests that whatever your hand does should be led by the heart.
I couldn't help thinking in reading your book of Faulkner's famous Nobel Prize speech where he talked about great art being the result of the heart against itself. But I also wanted to ask you about, Cupid and shooting arrows in the heart and where that, and Valentine's Day. Where does Valentine's Day link up to all this?
Valentine's Day has a very curious history. It starts, of course, with Saint Valentine, a 3rd century saint who is canonized around 500. And then Saint Valentine more or less disappears from documentation. But he appears once again in the late 14th century in the context of courtly love in a poem by Chaucer in the 1380s. And Chaucer speaks about St. Valentine's Day as the day when birds come together to choose their mate. That's an odd allusion for Valentine's Day in England. It would make a lot more sense for us in California to think of birds coming together as the harbingers of spring and of love. And that catches on both in France and in England. And so from that point on, you have this association between Saint Valentine and lovers.
Since you mentioned France, and that is your bailiwick for many years, Marilyn Yellam Nguyen, of course, for her scholarship on gender and many books that she's written about many subjects, but also very much openly a Francophile. You talk about the 12th century troubadours in France, in the south of France. I mean,
well, that's really the beginning of the great Western association between the heart and secular love. You certainly have in the 12th century, the troubadours in the south of France singing over and over again how they are giving their heart to the beloved. And it is always in the context that one has only one love, and she is usually a woman of elevated status. And then the minstrels in the north of France and in Germany, they pick up the same theme, and the word heart is like a leitmotif that runs through all of their poetry. But all of those associations and even verbal associations that enter the language, broken heart, wearing one's heart on one's sleeve, and of course much later you get Shakespeare's contributions to the vocabulary of the heart. But in the 12th and 13th and 14th century, you have what the French called fin amour, which was refined love or perfect love, and that's what we today call courtly love. And it's in this context that pine cone-shaped heart first appeared in the offering of the heart, and that within 100 years you have the perfect symmetrical heart, which we all know and which is now worldwide.
Do we know where bleeding hearts come from?
I don't know where bleeding hearts come from, and I'd like to know that. I've tried to track down a lot of the verbal expressions. I know that heart's content comes from Shakespeare, that wearing one's heart on one's sleeve comes from Shakespeare. Of course, it's based upon the medieval tournaments where a man would wear the color of his lady on his sleeve. And on, not just in English, but in other languages as well.
Our guest is Marilyn Yellum, and her new book is called The Amorous Heart, An Unconventional History of Love. Let me invite you to join this conversation. If you have some thoughts or questions about the amorous heart or about the heart and its link to Valentine's Day or its link historically, which is really where Marilyn Yellum takes us on her odyssey in this new book of hers, we'd like to hear from you. Questions or comments are welcome, and please feel free to join the conversation. Our toll-free number is available. Let me give you that number. It's 866-733-6786, and we do invite you to join us now with questions or comments. Again, the toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or if you just have something you want to say from your heart, we would certainly like to hear from you as well. You can email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website and post any questions or comments there, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, but please feel free to join the program. I learned a lot in your book, Marilyn, as I always do when I read you, and I learned something that I had no idea about, and maybe some of our listeners did, but we said that this all started with you in the British Museum, and the British royalty used to be buried apart from, with the heart apart from their bodies, and the Habsburgs in Austria did the same thing?
Yes, it started in France. During the Crusades, sometimes the body could not be sent back to the homeland, and so the heart was sent instead. It was preserved, and it would find its way to a royal vault. And then, with Richard the Lionhearted, we begin to see hearts that are taken out of the body and buried separately in a different location, usually a church, and the body would be buried in another place. In France, the bodies of royalty were traditionally buried at Saint-Denis, a church right outside of Paris. But the heart might be sent to Normandy or even as far back in some instances as England. And this went on right up through the 17th century. Of course, those poor hearts were often destroyed along with the bodies at the time of the French Revolution. And Louis XIV came to a very sad end in that both his heart was ground up for what was called mumia, that was paint, and his body, which was buried at Saint-Denis, and his entrails, which were buried elsewhere, all of them were thrown into a mass pit.
Again, we're talking to scholar and author Marilyn Yellum, and let me bring a caller on here. And John, that's you. John, you're on.
Yeah. Thanks for making that call. I have a rather crude question, and it's okay. The shape of the heart to the female buttock is turned upside down. We all think we all know this reference, but I'd like to know if there's any substance to it.
Marilyn Yellum, the female buttocks and the heart shape?
Well, this is my theory about why the heart is so captivating. First of all, I think it responds to our platonic longing to merge with our soulmate. So you have these two half-hearts that are merged together in one perfect heart. But on another level, I agree with the caller that the two lobes suggest buttocks, it suggests breasts, and it's a more sensual, there are more sensual associations, not just for women in the mind of men, but for men in the mind of women.
Well, this was not what Augustine wanted to be associated with the heart.
Not at all.
Yeah. Let me thank the caller. Speaking of hearts and I was really struck by the dedication of your book. Marilyn Yalom's husband is Irv Yalom, famous psychiatrist and author, novelist. Big-hearted husband. How do we come to think of people as big-hearted, meaning just generous and philanthropic, even kind?
Yes, we do have so many expressions that speak about a big-hearted person or a great-hearted person. And sometimes the idea is that that person is not just generous but courageous. There's an association between love on the one hand and courage or bravery in the other. You even find that in French in the association between the two words, cœur for heart and courage for courage. On the other hand, you have expressions like small-hearted or chicken-hearted. And I was very interested to discover that in the past, some of the theorists believed that the liver played an important role in our emotions, so that you have expressions like lily-livered alongside chicken-hearted. But yes, my husband is big-hearted. He saw to it that I was here today on time.
Well, we'll go to more calls. But first, let me read something from a listener who writes, I've heard that the international heart shape is based on the shape of a seed of an ancient contraceptive named silphium, which is now thought to be extinct. Is there any truth to this?
This is what I discovered from several years of research. The shape that we call the heart shape was around from about 6th century B.C., in what was ancient Libya, and I'll get back to that silphium seed. It turns up in Persia in the 6th century, and it turns up on various manuscripts. But it had no association with the heart, and it probably had no association with love. Christopher de Hamel, whose wonderful book, Meetings with Remarkable Manuscripts. He was kind enough to have an email exchange with me and to agree that those early hearts were pure embellishment. They are what I think of as a figure in search of a meaning. And the meaning doesn't come along until around 1300 in the context of courtly love. And then that shape is associated with the heart and with love.
How did this spread across the whole globe, though? Because it did, really.
It does spread across the globe. It spreads across the globe through the religious imagery, because you have the Sacred Heart of Jesus, which, by the way, is usually closer to the actual organ. It's a little lopsided and it's more fleshly. But then with Luther in the 16th century, the symmetrical heart takes over because Luther uses it in his personal seal. He even single-handedly saved the heart icon from iconophobes in the Protestant world who wanted to get rid of all the Catholic symbols. No, Luther kept the symbol alive, and it was kept alive in the Protestant world. And that was between the Catholics and the Protestants that symbol began to be exported. And one thing that is very important for Americans to know is that symbol came to this country in part through Pennsylvania Dutch, Dutch being a deformation of the word Deutsch, meaning German. So it was the Pennsylvania Germans, the Pennsylvania Dutch, who brought that symbol to what were the colonies in the 18th century. And you find it in their baptism manuscripts, in their embroidery, in their shutters. And it took hold in this country, so it was already one of the most popular symbols in the United States during the 19th century.
It's fascinating to learn that Luther, who purged services from having Latin to have the what was called the Vulgate German, kept the heart.
He kept the heart, and he put it right into his personal symbol, which was a cross in the center, within a heart, within a white rose. And he was determined that that seal, his personal seal, would more or less be exported into the Protestant world. And it was, and I saw it recently in a children's coloring book on the 500th anniversary of his posting his theses at Wittenberg.
You realize how ubiquitous the symbol has become, particularly in American kitsch culture. I mean, you can't get away from it. You got bumper stickers with "I heart, you know, Newfoundland dogs" or "I heart chili" or whatever. I mean, it just goes extensively to about everything.
Well, we owe that to "I heart New York," which was created by Milton Glaser in 1977. I've walked in today with a bag that says "I heart Paris," and then with the emoji that were developed in Japan, primarily in 1999, and had five small hearts among the original heart emoji. And now they're all over the place. You know, I'm sure you see them all the time when you get an email. And if you don't have the little heart symbol, then you can make it up by putting together, I don't know what you would call it, but something that looks like a point and a three, and that makes the heart emoticon.
And we'll bring in more of our callers. Let me go to Guerneville and welcome you, Jim. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you very much. I'm wondering if either one of you are familiar with the findings of evolutionary researcher Joseph Chilton Pierce.
No, I'm sorry.
Sorry, I don't know. Neither of us. Why do you bring him up?
Well, you can give Jim. Yeah, give him a Google.
Give him a Google.
This one of Yeah, sorry, I know.
No, I like that phrase. But, go ahead.
Thank you. One of his things that he teaches is that before there was a brain, there was the heart way back in the evolutionary scales. And before we had a brain, we thought with our heart. The beings on this planet thought with our heart. And he says that that heart tissue most closely resembles nerve tissue, and that we feel things there. And I'm also reminded of the Chinese five-element theory that teaches that anger is in the liver, fear in the kidneys, and love in the heart. Anyway, I'm wondering what your comments on things like this. They're a little out there, but I'll take your answers on the line. Thank you.
All right, thank you for the call. Marilyn Yellum.
Well, long before Harvey discovered that the heart was a pump and the emphasis of consciousness was on the brain, long before philosophers and physicians believed that the heart was the center not only of emotion but of thinking. So there was a big switch in the 17th century with William Harvey, and some people agreed with him and some disagreed with him and thought that the heart was merely a spring or a pump. But I always think of what Pascal wrote: the heart has its reasons that reason knows nothing about. So,
or as Woody Allen said, the heart wants what it wants.
The heart wants what it wants. So there is still to this day a distinction, at least in language, between the thinking brain and the feeling heart.
Well, that's very Cartesian, isn't it? You know, I think, therefore I am, and that kind of bifurcated division that's so much a part of Western culture. Let me bring another caller on, and Rob, that's you. Hi.
Hi, thank you, Michael. I love your erudition, Dr. Yellum. There's another citation, Ornament of the World, How Muslims, Jews, and Christians Created a Culture of Tolerance in Medieval Spain by Maria Rosa Menocal, kind of a famous book. Now, I think it's there where I read that all the tradition of the troubadours and the minstrels and the courtly love of Andalusia, southern Spain, and then which went out into wider Europe, perhaps, that originated with Islam, with the Muslims, and their tradition of poetry, etc. And now there are other works like the myth of Andalusian paradise that more recently that maybe contradict that. But where do you come down on that? Because they seem to, you know, the first book I mentioned seems to say that it entirely came from that Muslim tradition.
It doesn't entirely come from the Muslim tradition, but the Muslim tradition is very, very important in the origins of courtly love, and particularly the troubadour in the south of France. I have a chapter in this book on Arabic songs from the heart. And indeed, it is their poetry, pre-Islamic for the most part, that creates many, many of the images that we will find in troubadour poetry. The heart that's often sad and filled with longing for a specific woman. And the whole sense that develops that the woman is to be loved permanently, even if she's someone else's wife, and even if it can't be consummated. That is a piece of the courtly tradition that develops in France, particularly in the north of France, and that can be traced directly back to the Arabic poetry and also to some of the Arabic thinkers, one in particular whose name is Ibn Hazm, who wrote a treatise on love that was picked up by the French in the 12th and 13th centuries.
Let me thank you for the call, Rob, and go to a comment for a question actually from Monica, who says, I'm wondering if anyone has discovered if isolated indigenous people with limited exposure to other cultures likewise connected the heart to feelings of love. In other words, is it truly universal?
That's a good question. And of course, I usually limit myself to Western culture, although one finds in the Japanese characters for love that the character for heart is right within it. And so someone else should really pick up on this theme. But over and over again, you find that the heart is implicated in love, in our strongest emotions, because it does pound faster, or at least flutter, when someone whom you love comes into view.
Be still my heart. So it goes.
Be still my heart.
Always good to have you, Marilyn. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michael.
Marilyn Yellum, senior scholar now at Stanford University's Clayman Institute for Gender Research. Her new book is The Amorous Heart, An Unconventional History of Love. Sorry we couldn't get to all the calls and emails, but thank you, those of you who joined us this hour, by call or email. And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. For all of us here at KQED Public Radio, talk with you tomorrow. I'm Michael Krasny.